From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you've been to Sacramento International Airport, you've probably experienced the infamous Terminal B. It's a small, outdated building that doesn't even come close to the world-class image Sacramento boosters want the city to project. But by this time tomorrow, the embarrassing Terminal B will be replaced by a glitzy-looking new pair of buildings, the Central Terminal and a concourse, connected by a small train called the People Mover. This has been a huge project, costing nearly $1 billion, and it's been controversial. Airlines have said it's too expensive, and the weak economy means the airport has less of a cushion than investors usually like. A few days ago, while construction was still underway, we took a tour of the Central Terminal and the concourse, and a ride on the People Mover. Our hosts were the man who designed it, Brent Kelly of Corgan Architects, and the man who supervised the Central Terminal construction, Ralph Ketchum of Austin Walsh. I started by asking Brent Kelly to describe where we were in the new terminal.
Well, we are actually at the new pedestrian bridge, which connects the existing Garage A directly into Central Terminal B. This is an elevated walkway that is 44 feet above the ground, and it gives us a straight shot into the transfer level of the terminal.
This parking garage was already built. It was built a few years ago, not part of this project. Was it designed so that you could have this kind of walkway into the new terminal?
It was not designed that way, and so we had to add an additional circulation core with elevators and stairs and so forth, and then modify the inside of the garage so that we could create a new portal that is directed towards Terminal B.
And Ralph, is there a particular challenge about building something like this out of a large building that didn't have this in mind into a large new building across the road?
Yes, and particularly because of the existing structure, we had to essentially add on to something that had already been designed and built in a different manner. And then the bridge itself was erected in one piece, as far as the structure goes.
How do you mean erected in one piece? It's huge.
It was lifted into place in one piece.
And how do you do that?
You get a very big crane.
A very big crane.
Yes.
And I'm guessing this was put in place after the Central Terminal was built.
Structure was complete, yes. On the Central Terminal.
And Brent, also underneath us here is a new elevated roadway.
That is correct. As part of the Central Terminal B program, we took the arriving function and the departing functions, and we separated them by an elevation change. So on the structured roadway, those passengers who are departing Sacramento or leaving flying out of Sacramento, they'll be dropped off via the upper level roadway. Arriving passengers will be met at the lower level roadway.
When Terminal A was built about 10, 11 years ago, I remember hearing that it was designed so that it could be expanded.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it not expanded, and instead, why was this built, and how is this different so that it can be expanded?
Yeah, the thought in Terminal A when it was constructed was that the concourse, or where the gates are located, the aircraft gates are located, the building can be expanded onto. The ticketing and bag claim was also designed that, but at a grade level expansion, not a vertical expansion. What we found with the difficulty with Terminal A is because it was constructed with a single level roadway, that is where the design broke down, if you will. And it was the fact of cars being congested on that roadway started causing delays of passengers getting through. We've designed Central Terminal B such with that separation so that departing and arriving are separated. And then this building is also designed that it can expand to the south, adding more ticketing and bag claim function when necessary.
You mean you could add on more building to what is currently here?
Yes. So where we have the landscape area to the south, that area can be taken in and the building can be expanded to the south.
How much more capacity would that add?
We could actually double the size of the building. We've got enough room to actually double the size of the building. So that actually would take us well into the future, probably 2030, 2040 timeframe.
And Ralph Ketchum, I don't know if you'd be involved in that, but what would that involve to take a heavily used large building and add on to it years down the line?
Well, since it was designed to do that, it would be fairly easy, and particularly with the central landscape area, because we could isolate that from the existing traffic and the existing passengers, which would be the major issue in adding on to structure that's being utilized.
I'm talking with Brent Kelly and Ralph Ketchum, two of the lead people in charge of the construction, the design and construction of the new central terminal at Sacramento International Airport. Right now we're on the walkway leading from the garage into the terminal. Let's walk into the terminal now and get sort of an overview of the whole building. Well, we've left the walkway from the garage. Brent, could you say exactly where we are and what we're looking at?
Yeah, we're at the transfer level of the central terminal.
The top floor.
This is where you actually make your transfer from the terminal to the concourse building via the automated people mover system. This is also kind of our general meter and greeter area where we're really encouraging passengers as well as those who drop them off or pick them up to assemble here on this level, have a leisurely time, if you will, if you've got the time. There's coffee, there's food, there's things that you can see and do from this level. So it's a more convenient waiting level, if you will, than the existing building where you do that in the baggage claim. At this level, we can actually look down over the ticketing hall. That is where passengers actually at level two make their way into the building, drop off their bags, get their tickets before making their way up here and out to the people mover and concourse. At this level also, you can see all the way down to level one, which is the bag claim hall. So we've designed the space such that whether you're departing from Sacramento or you're arriving into Sacramento, all passengers will be able to experience the uniqueness of this space by passing through it.
I feel like I'm in a tall building here. I have a hunch that a lot of people, when they come here, are going to go, wow, this looks like a real airport. And no offense to the existing Terminal A and Terminal B, but was that part of the remit from the airport?
That really was one of the things that we gathered early on from working with the airport staff was the idea that Sacramento really needed a statement. It is the capital of the state of California, and so it needed to really reflect the importance of the city within the state. So we looked at that as far as being able to really create a dynamic space, that kind of wow space, as you referred to, and also one that was very open and transparent.
The roof of this building, the central terminal, it's kind of shaped like multiple arches. From the outside, it could look like waves or hills or something like that. What does it look like?
It is kind of reflective of the terminal's location in the Central Valley. The idea of reflecting the mountain ranges and the foothills to either side, to the east and the west, and that is why the roof height varies, kind of reflecting that kind of hill forms. It also then functionally, the way the roof pops higher is also significant of where you actually enter the building. So it also gives you a clue of entry into the building.
There are a lot of very distinctive features, but some of the walls are sloping outwards from the ground. They slope outwards as you go up, and there's a lot of glass in these windows. Brent, why did you design the walls to slope outwards?
Well, again, the idea that it's paying homage to the mountain ranges to the east and west, number one. But secondly, by sloping the glass, it does a couple of things for us. One, it helps in deflecting the direct heat that would come into the building from the outside. And secondly, it helps us with our acoustics within the building. You see a lot of hard surfaces within the building, but yet it is a very, very comfortable space to be in and carry on a dialogue without hearing echoes and things of that nature.
Ralph, there's a lot of glass and metal in this building, but when I look up, I see what looks like really nice wood on the ceiling, if that's the right word in this context. What is that wood?
It's recycled redwood and maple, and it's one of the features that really was exciting for us to install and really made a difference, because you don't normally see something like that. I think it reflects the sustainability of the building a little bit. And it definitely reflects something. When you walk in and you look up, there's only one word for it. It's wow.
What would be more typical material for the ceiling?
Well, there's a variety of materials. Metal is
usually used
in something like this. But this one was really special because of that.
Well, Brent, why did you decide to go this route? I'm guessing it's probably more expensive.
Actually, a lot of that depends on how you what materials you choose. One of the keys for our decision in the design is the redwood that Ralph was mentioning was recycled redwood that the county was able to retain from the old Thornton Thornton Road Bridge that connected Sacramento County to San Joaquin County. That bridge was damaged in the late 90s. The county decided they needed to take it down, and they salvaged the redwood. We took that redwood, some of that redwood, had it reinvented itself, if you will, from a bridge structure into a ceiling. So we brought a lot of history. That wood was, the bridge was erected back in the 1930s. So a lot of history of the county brought it back here into this building rather than that wood ending up in the landfill. The other thing with the light maple wood, which it serves a couple of purposes, it is actually acoustic value to that. So it's a slotted wood that allows the sound to be absorbed within the ceiling. But it also brings some warmth into a building that you otherwise want to be very hard, durable surfaces because of the abuse an airport facility will take.
There's a lot of public art in this building. Brent, did you have any say over what the art would be, what it would look like, where it would go? Or was that something that was outside of your job?
No, we participated with the Sacramento Metropolitan Arts Commission in both identifying artists to be a part of the program and then working very closely with the commission to look at the locations within the building that would be the most appropriate for the types of art that we were looking for.
Now, the most famous piece of art in this central terminal is the gigantic red rabbit that looks like it's jumping into the terminal building, heading down towards the baggage claim. I don't know if the rabbit is heavy, but how do you keep it up there safely?
Well, the rabbit weighs about 14,000 pounds.
That's heavy.
It is heavy, but in the big picture of the structure of this building, it is very small. From regards to what the structure can bear. As Ralph mentioned, part of the contract for the building was to provide the connection points. The artist had to bring in the engineer of how to engineer the rabbit and how to suspend the rabbit. Certainly, Austin Walsh was an integral part of that in working with them to make sure they got it into the building and got it hoisted into place.
Okay, well, we'll continue our tour of the central terminal. We'll head over to the trains and go over to the concourse.
Next stop, Terminal B. Doors are closing. Stand clear of doors.
Well, we're on the train now, which is heading over to Terminal B.
Please hold on. Train is departing.
Well, we're heading out of the little station of the airport. We're now out in the open air.
Please hold on. This train is departing for air sign B.
Well, it's a great view here. You can see all the way across most of the airport. And we can see the back of the old Terminal
Please
B that will be toast pretty soon.
That is correct. It'll be torn down in a few months.
Well, already we're pulling into the train station at Terminal B. Brent, why build a train? This must have added quite a bit of cost. Was there no more direct way to the gate?
Well, one of the things we look at is passenger experience, and we want to make sure that the walk distance is not too great. So one of the things that we looked at as we started defining where the building would fit within the site, we had to take into account our actual buildable area. And when we looked at where it would fit, one of the things that naturally made sense was a separation of the buildings. The added benefit to separating the buildings is also from a security standpoint. We pushed the aircraft further away from the general public, who have not been screened for security reasons. And so that also assisted with the security. But in doing the train, we had two choices, either a train or a walkway. And by the time you build a walkway that is fully enclosed, air-conditioned, moving sidewalks, all of those types of things, you would have spent the same amount of money.
I seem to remember hearing that there was a concern about people getting onto the train, coming over here without tickets. Why is security over here as opposed to over there? Because if it was over there, then no one without a ticket could get onto the people mover.
One of the things about the airport terminal as it has expanded is not only this building, the Central Terminal B complex, but eventually the master plan is designed that the old Terminal A could actually be converted to an airside building. So we've got on the west side capacity to build a third concourse. So the idea is eventually what we refer to as Central Terminal B will simply be the Central Terminal. And so from that point, all passengers would head out to their gates. By diversifying where the security checkpoint is located, so in other words, at each concourse, we diversify the crowds, number one. And secondly, if there ever is a security event, you only have to empty and rescreen a single concourse versus everybody.
That's Brent Kelly, Design Director of Corgan Architects. And also with us on this tour was Ralph Ketchum of Austin Walsh, in charge of the construction and the land side part of the project. Well, since we don't have tickets for any airplanes today, we'll have to take the train back to the Central Terminal. Thank you all.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, should Sacramento use federal money to hire police officers right away or salt away the money in case finances get even worse? We'll talk about that and more with Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us with information about what's online at Insight is Jen Picard. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. Well, we just heard you, Jeffrey, take a tour of the new Central Terminal at the Sacramento Airport, and we wanted to hear our listeners' thoughts on it. Listener Ann Forlenza is worried that the new system will be a pain and mean extra prep time for passengers preparing to leave Sacramento. I take my daughter to the airport every other week as she has visitation with her dad in Oregon. The planning for that extra time to check in and then take the tram and go through security will be a hassle. The planning of all these extra delays to board a plane was not thought out. Did they create this so more people would be stuck at the airport to spend more money on shopping and eating? I will go next Friday and I will leave extra early and hope my daughter makes her flight without having to take her out of school early.
Happy camper.
Yes. If you have any thoughts or comments on the new Central Terminal, feel free to send an email to insight@capradio.org or comment on our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio. You can also see a panoramic view and a slideshow of the new Terminal B in a special section of our website, and you can take a ride on that people mover. Just go to capradio.org/insight.
Thanks, Jen.
You are welcome.
The first Wednesday of each month, we talk about top stories in the news and sports with Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone, and he joins us. Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, do you think that the new Central Terminal is the thing that will finally tip Sacramento into world-class territory?
Oh, dear, Jeffrey. It looks like a lovely airport terminal. I myself have not written about the airport terminal because virtually everybody else has.
I've been looking for a column in that, but to no avail.
No, not for me. I think it's very nice. I do remember Terminal B. It reminded me of the airports back in the 1960s, and it needed to be done. It took a long time. It cost a lot of money, and it's what's passing for news in Sacramento these days. So I'm happy for them that it's open, and I look forward to flying in and out of there in the future. And that's about all I have to say about the subject.
I guess you're suggesting perhaps that if this building was opening in New York or Los Angeles, it wouldn't be getting all the coverage.
No, it wouldn't. And not to say that it shouldn't, but, you know, because it is, stressing the positive, it is an example that things can get done after all, even though they take an awfully long time. It is an airport terminal after all. It looks very nice, colleagues have gone out there and said that it is beautiful. I will probably fly through there at some point in the future, and I'll check it out for myself at that point.
Yes. In your column today, you say Sacramento should hire 25 cops right away with the money the city is getting from the federal government. Why would the city not hire cops right away? Because that's what the money's supposed to be for, isn't it?
It's what it's supposed to be for. However, there has been an internal debate within City Hall that perhaps the prudent thing to do would be to wait. The city is facing $12 million in additional cuts next year. And that the money could soften the blow. You know, if the city went about doing that, you wonder what the feds would have to say about it. But I also wanted to write about this issue because police politics are very interesting in Sacramento. We have a liberal city, and in my opinion, there remains sort of the vestiges of kind of liberal unease with law enforcement. Sacramento has one of the smallest police departments for its size in the nation. And even though the statistics have shown that violent crimes have gone down in the last 4 years, those numbers were largely tabulated when the police department was larger than it is now. They laid off 42 officers earlier in the year.
Also, there have been demographic changes nationwide that have tended to reduce violent crime.
Yes. However, you know, having an already small department and then shrinking it even more, I don't think is a good way to go. And so the 25 officers presents an opportunity to bring people who are needed back onto the streets. And seeing as that there were 42 who were let go, there probably are 25 who could be hired back immediately. I think it's the way that the city is going to go eventually, but it is an interesting issue that it sort of arrived at the dawn of this political season when the for example, the police union is going to have something to say about who's elected next year. And if you believe kind of the chatter around town, there are scores to be settled among certain council members who are up for re-election. That's always fun. And the fact remains that with this big realignment of the Department of Corrections, there are going to be more offenders coming to our county no matter what. So having an additional boost to the police staff would be nothing but a good thing.
Mayor Johnson has said publicly that he thinks the money should be used right away to hire police officers. Right. So who's saying, either in public or not, that maybe we should wait?
I think there's an internal debate at City Hall among bureaucrats. I think that the issue has gotten the attention at this point that would probably scare off any kind of talk of that. And my understanding, I wasn't at the meeting last night, but that the new city manager, John Shirey, is now starting to talk openly about bringing 25 officers on. You know, it is being able to account for these officers down the line. There's no good answers for that right now. So that is problematic, but the Fed's money is for 3 years. And so you're bringing people on for 3 years and then trying to figure out how you keep them on beyond that. And there's no answer for that right now. And the hopes is that there'll be answers for that in the future. It's not the perfect solution, obviously. Having a sustainable tax base to support the department is the best way to go. But in short of that, 3-year federal money is better than dipping into reserves, which was another idea kicked around earlier this year.
And those reserves are pretty slender.
Pretty slender. Since the city's having to borrow money just to make payroll, it's probably not a good way to go.
Marcus Bertone is my guest. He's a Sacramento Bee columnist. His columns usually appear in the paper's Our Region section on Wednesdays and Sundays. He also writes for the Bee Sports section and is on Insight the first Wednesday of each month. I read in the paper today that arena planning talks, it seems like there are always arena planning talks starting, but there's a new round of arena planning talks starting today in Dallas. With the NBA, the city, the developer group, and the company that would operate the arena. And I noticed one very notable omission from that, and that is the Maloofs, who would, in theory, be the principal tenants at said arena. What do you make of that? Should we be concerned about the fact the Maloofs aren't at the table?
No, I don't believe we should be concerned. I believe that we should probably be relieved that they're not at the table. It's an interesting question, Jeffrey. It's one that is going to emerge, I predict, is going to emerge. The ultimate viability of the Kings owners, I think, is going to be a big question. Before we can arrive at that question, these issues have to be sorted out as to whether an arena even pencils out in Sacramento. And that's what these meetings will begin to determine. The fact that the NBA is taking the lead in this, I think, does say a lot in terms of where the league's priorities are. And a little bit, even though they would never admit it, sort of how they feel about the Maloofs. I have no proof of this. It's just my opinion. But that there is, my opinion is that there is big concern and doubts within the league with respect to the long-term viability of the Kings owners. They no longer control the casino that they helped make their name.
In Vegas,
Las Vegas, the Palms Casino. Look, I mean, George Maloof is the most valuable employee there. He's running the place, but they no longer have a controlling stake. And so when you don't have your core business anymore, when you've sold your family's beer distributorship, which built the empire that you used to have, you begin to wonder how do these owners survive in a game where the other owners are largely billionaires— making their money elsewhere.
So I understand that you're speculating here, but what you're suggesting might be going on is that the NBA and maybe other parties here are looking at the Maloofs and saying, well, you know, these guys might not be around for the long term, so maybe they're not the best people to be at the talks.
Well, I think that that's sort of beneath the surface. And again, the NBA would never admit that. The
sure.
city would never admit that. Nobody, certainly the Maloofs would never admit that. But, their situation is what it is. And the NBA, the Kings are, well, there's no league and there may not be a season at this point, given where the NBA talks are. But the Kings are only in Sacramento because the NBA wants them to be here. The Maloofs didn't want to be here and likely would have filed for relocation if they hadn't gotten strong signals from the league that they shouldn't, and they didn't. So the league wants to investigate further whether Sacramento is a viable NBA market, and in the meantime, play footsie with Anaheim to have a place for the Kings to land if Sacramento is determined not to be. But the fact that the Kings owners aren't there is just an extension of what's been going on for some time now, to where the league basically inserted themselves into this process. The league has basically been running. The Kings have brought people into Arco Arena and have had a say in what's been going on there for some time now. It's just sort of the way it's been, that it's really the NBA running the show and not the Maloofs.
And finally, Marcus, you wrote a couple of columns in the last few weeks about the San Francisco Giants. When you go from the World Series one season to not making the playoffs the next season, that looks like a failed season. But you made the case that Giants fans needn't feel too bad.
Well, the point that I was trying to make is that, sometimes in baseball and life, things don't go your way. And that certainly was the case this year, to where you had several severe injuries that resulted in the best hitters on the team being lost for the season and lost for large portions of the season. And so when you have that on a team that's already struggling to score runs, you have a very frustrating season where you have the pitching that was there to be able to win a World Series, but Jeffrey, that you and I might have had better luck trying to drive in runs than some of the people the Giants ran out there during the season. And that was particularly excruciating in August and September. And, the Giants had hopes of winning the World Series again and putting themselves in the same stratosphere as the New York Yankees and Boston Red Sox, because it's very lucrative. I mean, they were coining it this year, selling 2010 memorabilia, and every game was sold out. And they tapped into something, to where women, young people all flocked to the ballpark, and every game was festive, and there was more going on there than just baseball. And everyone loves a winner, obviously, but being able to win the World Series and do what they did, I think, was huge for business, and they were really hoping to replicate that this year.
And even if the injuries are dealt with in the off season, do you think the Giants have enough in the tank to make a serious go next year, or has that window closed?
No, I don't think it's closed. I think the people who are going to take them there are they're young pitchers who they still control all of them for at least one more year, and they're trying to extend that. I don't know how much money is going to be left if you lock a Matt Cain and Tim Lincecum up for long term contracts. Look, I mean, they have an issue. They don't have a leadoff hitter and a center fielder. They still have a big question mark at shortstop. The first base was a black hole, and their catching position was a black hole. You take all those positions out of the lineup, and it's kind of tough to score runs, and it was. And when you consider that they lost 37 games where the opponent scored 3 runs or less, they lost 15 games where the opponent scored 2 runs or less, and when you only had to win 5 more games to be in the playoffs, so we're talking about a matter of runs that separates you from being in the postseason, and then anything can happen. Yeah, it's frustrating, number one, and if you can just add a few pieces, then maybe you're in that mix again, and then you have the chance to hit the jackpot again.
Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. You can read his columns usually in our region on Wednesdays and Sundays. He's on Insight the first Wednesday of each month. Marcus, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, Egypt, the story behind the revolution.
Thank you.
You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with details is Capital Public Radio senior editor Alan Ray. He's in the newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Another indication from Davis about why the UC there has become a major player in health research in the United States. Researchers have discovered a protein called galectin 12. They say it plays a key role in fat storage, and they say that finding that could lead to improvements in treating obesity and diabetes. Now, the researchers found that without the ability to make this protein, mice used in their research stored 40% less body fat and had increased fat metabolism and decreased insulin resistance. And that's all important because diabetes has become such a huge health problem in this country, and one of the best ways of predicting diabetes is taking a look and seeing who's obese.
Well, let's hope that translates from the mice to the humans.
Well, let's hope. Our health reporter, Pauline Bartoloni, will be talking to the people at Davis who did the research, and we'll have that story this afternoon. Senate Democratic leaders in Washington, D.C. have proposed a 5% surtax on people with incomes of more than $1 million a year. They want to use the money, they say about $445 billion over 10 years, to pay for the job creation package that President Obama wants. The Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said his proposal would have the richest pay a little bit more, 5% more for creation of jobs to ensure the country's economic success. That from Harry Reid. We haven't heard yet from the Republicans about that. Those stories and more coming up this afternoon, beginning at 3:30 on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
Alan, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Arab Spring didn't start in Egypt, but that was where the revolutions against authoritarian leaders really captured the world's attention. We all saw the climactic and dramatic events in Tahrir Square in Cairo as protesters demanded change and as Hosni Mubarak stood down. But what was it like for the people there? A documentary telling some of their stories will be shown tomorrow in Sacramento. It's called Egypt, the Story Behind the Revolution. And the filmmaker, the producer and director, will be there at Sacramento State for the showing. He joins us right now by phone. Khaled Syed, thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Are you from Egypt?
Yeah, I'm originally from Egypt. I actually moved to the U.S. 11 years ago.
Yes. And tell us how this film came to be made. When did you decide that you needed to go back to Egypt to make this film?
Well, I always wanted to do a movie about the Egyptian politics, but I don't know if you know that, but the dictator there had a really good hold of the people and was ruling Egypt with an iron fist. So people won't talk to me about politics in the street anywhere because they were afraid to just get, you know, taken away to jails or secret cells all over Egypt. So when the revolution happened, unfortunately, I could not go to participate. But as it finished, I grabbed my camera and I just went to Egypt and interviewed activists and people who actually were street from day one.
If you were still living in Egypt, do you think you would have participated in the revolution?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You said that for many years, people in Egypt, most people in Egypt, were very nervous about expressing their views on politics and so on because of the way the state was run at that time under Hosni Mubarak. What changed then? What gave so many people the courage to go out into the streets and say, we want this to end, we want change?
I think people had enough, and the people who started the revolution were really savvy activists who started this movement online. But as soon as this movement moved to the street, a lot of people saw it and they wanted to be part of it because, as you will see in the movie, the last 10 years, they just the whole situation, economic situation, social justice, police brutality, it just increased tremendously, and people just couldn't have, couldn't deal with it anymore.
How did you decide which people you wanted to talk to when you went back to Egypt to make this film about the revolution?
Well, I was in touch with a lot of them over the phone to see their progress. And when I went home, I got in touch with them, and some of them were friends of these activists. And it was Facebook. I have to I have to say, I contacted with them through Facebook and Twitter, and once I got in Egypt, they were really motivated and passionate to tell their stories, the real story that happened and why the revolution happened in the place.
My guest is Khaled Syed, who's a filmmaker. His documentary, Egypt, The Story Behind the Revolution, is being shown early tomorrow afternoon at Sacramento State. Well, the revolution peaked in January. You went there in March. How did people feel at that time about the revolution? Were they as hopeful and as excited, or was there any disillusionment that you started to notice then?
Well, the thing is, people were excited. People were really optimistic. People thought they, going to get Mubarak, put him to jail, or even put him on trial. But no, now that's not true. I mean, 6 or 8 months later, he's still in the hospital claiming that he's sick, and he got like two court viewing, and he haven't been in jail. A lot of the promises and demand from the activists haven't been met yet. So there was a lot of sense of optimism, and a lot of people were happy that the revolution succeeded and they were actually able to remove the regime. And some of their hopes are kind of unrealistic, but it was like a feeling after winning something really big, they never thought they would actually win or even start it.
You said there that Hosni Mubarak is claiming that he's sick. Why do you say he's claiming that he's sick?
Well, the thing is, the last speech he gave, he didn't seem to be sick. And the days leading the revolution, nobody knew anything about his sickness. It just suddenly happened when the Egyptian people demanded him to be put on trial. So we didn't see any statement from doctor or anybody saying that he's actually sick. It's a speculation, but it's fair to say that he's just putting that show on, and especially when he showed the first time on TV to court, he was on a bed and he was looking, as an old sick man, and it worked, because a lot of people in Egypt later on, they were saying, an old man, whatever he did is fine, just let him go. But the rest of the people who actually started this movement is like, no, he have done a lot of bad things for our country, and he need to be put on trial. He ordered people to be killed, the revolution, and he need to be trialed.
For the record, people close to Mubarak have said that he has cancer. Now, what about the role of the army, which is a powerful institution in Egypt? If the army had intervened on Mubarak's side, then the revolution might have gone in a different direction, but they pretty much stayed on the sidelines. What do people today feel about the role of the army in the revolution, and what do they feel about what the army is doing today? What is the army doing today? What is its role in Egypt?
Well, it's interesting you're asking that, because what's happening and how the army or the military ruling Egypt now, they're going back to the same tactic Mubarak used. They're forcing a lot of censorship on all the media. They're doing a lot of military trial for civilians. So it seemed like the Egyptian people went back after the revolution, and the military kept telling them all this, or promising them all this emptiness, and they never delivered on any of these promises. So I don't think they're really better off with the military right now. The best thing we hope for right now is the parliament election that it's coming in November, which are going to be going back to Egypt to document this process, because, as you know, that's like the first democratic election that Egypt will have for like forever now.
And how do people, the people you've talked with, how do they feel about that parliamentary election coming up? Are they excited? Are they hopeful? Are they cautious? Are they skeptical?
Actually, it's all that, but they're really interested in seeing this election on its way. They wanted to vote. They want to practice their rights, and they wanted to see a civilian in power, not the military. They're not interested in having a military ruler, And as you said before, yes, the military kind of helped this revolution to kind of like succeed. But in the middle of it, like in February 2nd, they actually give Mubarak and his ways to go and actually attack to as a protester as a like last effort to kill this revolution, which didn't work. They call it the camel and horses battle, and it did not work. And then when the military noticed that the people just not going to go anywhere, they sided with the people. And I think in the end, yes, they did convince Mubarak to step down, but I don't think they're doing a good job of ruling Egypt right now.
Khaled Syed, he's a filmmaker. His documentary, Egypt, The Story Behind the Revolution, is being shown tomorrow afternoon at Sacramento State, specifically from noon to 2 at the Hind Auditorium at Sac State's University Union. Khaled Syed, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a spectacular exhibit of large paintings inspired by jazz music. You'll meet one of the artists. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Here's your weather. Winter is getting off to an early start around these parts, so you might be thinking about flu shots. In Truckee today, there's an adult flu clinic underway at the Nevada County Public Health Department. The clinic runs till noon, but take your umbrella and bundle up. Rain and showers expected to continue today in Truckee, and the high will only reach 41. In Stockton today, showers expected and a high of 63. If you're looking for something to do there tonight, what about a concert of classical music? The University of the Pacific Wind Ensemble will perform at the Fay Spanis Concert Hall. The featured composers will include Sousa. The concert starts at 7:30, but it will be windy this evening in the Central Valley with showers likely. Today's high in Sacramento, 63, 65 in Merced, 49 in Nevada City, and 54 in Sparks. It's going to be sunny, though, on Friday and through the weekend. The Jazz Art Project is a large ongoing project of jazz music inspired artworks, and it's been seen all over the place. But there's an exhibit of jazz art as it happens here at Capital Public Radio in our lobby, and there will be a reception this Saturday evening for a second Saturday. Joining us to talk about jazz art, what it's about, is one of the artists. But we'll start with the curator of the Jazz Art Project, Beverly Korenwasser. Beverly, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting us.
What's jazz art all about?
Well, jazz art is a reflection of the essence of jazz itself. You see what you've been hearing. It's visual music.
And are the people who make it jazz musicians who are also artists?
Most of the artists that create jazz art are musicians. E.J. Gold is a wonderful musician, has his own band. Kelly is a dancer. Been around music all her life.
And you'll meet Kelly in just a moment.
Robert Trice is a musician. Let's see, who else?
Okay, well, quite a few musicians involved with it, but
right.
E.G. Gold was the originator, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And it began when Wynton Marsalis came to our little town, Grass Valley, in 2001, and we were invited by the Nevada County Arts Council to create an art show with Wynton and to be on stage with him and to create a beautiful space with jazz art.
And that's a big deal in itself.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Well, how did it go from that to being what it is today, where there are a lot of artists involved and there are exhibits all over the place?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the beauties about jazz art is the teamwork that the artists have together in creating jazz art. But shortly after Marsalis left Grass Valley, we were visited by the production executive of the then International Association of Jazz Education, by their executive producer. We all sat around, had a cup of coffee, and he made this incredible decision to bring jazz art to the next IAJ convention.
We're talking about jazz art, and also in a studio is Kelly Rivera. Beverly alluded to Kelly a moment ago. Kelly is one of the artists in the Jazz Art Project. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
How much of a jazz musician are you?
Actually, my relationship to jazz, well, I used to see a lot of jazz in New York when I lived there, at the Blue Note and Village Vanguard, places like that. But I'm a flamenco dancer, and flamenco is all about rhythm, and rhythm is what keeps jazz together. You know, it can go apart, but it comes back together with rhythm. So,
how do you create your jazz artworks? I mean, what's your process? Do you immerse yourself in some music before you paint something?
Actually, during, and what I do, which is what I do with all of my art, basically, I put a texture of some sort on a canvas, and then I stare until I see, and then when I see, I strike. with my brush.
And is there a common theme to your jazz artworks?
Yeah, I would say that the common theme would be that I was always fascinated by the space that is created when the separate parts become one big whole, and it's as if the mood takes off into another dimension altogether, and I'm always trying to capture that mood and the lighting that is involved with that mood.
I'm looking at some of your jazz art paintings on the Jazz Art website, and all of these, I don't know how typical these are of your general work, but a lot of them, there's a lot of black in the paintings. I feel like I'm in a jazz club, a dark nightclub, yeah. And I'm looking at musicians who are illuminated, but around them it's very dark.
That's right.
A little smoky, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, that was kind of the game that we decided to play. Let's do this on a black canvas and see what happens.
Oh, so you didn't paint it black, the painting black. It was already blank.
You gesso the white canvas with black gesso, yeah. And then you come on top of that.
And that must change the colors that you're putting on top of the blank.
Yeah, it does. Well, the colors can pop. You know, it depends on the colors that you're using, of course. But if you use brilliant colors, especially what I do sometimes, my trick is I'll put a little bit of white first and then white gesso on top of the black gesso, and then some of the areas will pop out even more.
Are these actual jazz musicians that you've painted in these paintings, or are these jazz musicians in your imagination?
Some of them are in my imagination, and some of them are based on actual musicians. Like, I've seen portraits, but then I'll do my twist on the portrait. For example, Lady Singing Clear Through the Blue.
It's a beautiful painting.
Thank you so much. That's Billie Holiday, but with my dress on her.
I see. Also with us is Ivan Lurie, who's a professor of English at Sierra College, but he's also an art appreciator and a longtime associate of the Jazz Art Group of Painters. Ivan, welcome.
Thank you.
You've written articles about jazz art. What do you like about this so much?
Well, I've been thrilled, actually, since the beginning of this project, 10 or 12 years ago. And I think what excites me the most about it is this mixture of the art forms. You know, it's the thing that Wynton Marsalis took note of right away in 2001 there in Grass Valley. There's this wonderful statement that he made about the whole community coming out and supporting. You know, there were teachers, there were high school students, there were painters, musicians, and all of this was sort of all focused on jazz and the jazz theme. And I like this idea. I write poetry also, and I think, you know, that a lot of California poets like Al Young, who was the poet laureate for a couple of years, are
He's
inspired.
A big jazz fan.
Yeah. Well,
he does shows where he's doing poetry with jazz.
Actually,
in the background.
We were in those
Absolutely.
Shows.
Yes,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah, I would call him a jazz poet, you know, like a performance artist. And I've done that kind of work, too. It's great as a poet to work with jazz musicians. And, you know, it's just great to see the arts cross-fertilize. You know, there's actually, I brought this album along by a piece by Ted Nash called Portrait in Seven Shades, the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. Recorded a whole suite of compositions that Marsalis asked Ted Nash to do based on paintings. So this is art jazz. This is where he's taking Matisse and Van Gogh and Picasso and, you know, some of his favorite artists, particular paintings, which are actually portrayed in a little booklet here. And he has these wonderful impressionistic pieces which were recorded by Wynton Marsalis and the Lincoln Center Orchestra. So it's the inspiration goes back and forth. It's great.
Kelly, are the different jazz artworks by the different painters really quite distinct? I mean, someone look at these and go, oh, wow, that's Kelly's painting and this is someone else's?
We all have our own distinct style, for sure.
Yeah, and yet, Beverly, there seems to be a common thread among the jazz art paintings that I've seen.
That's one of the wonderful things that happened at the very beginning. All these artists came together and as a team, and one of the questions that came up was, how are we going to have our own expression through the painting and still have a cohesive look about the pieces? And they decided on a similar palette.
Exactly.
The palette would be whatever colors you think of as jazz, black, purples, dark reds, a little bit of white, yeah. And then, but you, distinctly between each artist, you can see the difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, if someone were to come by the Capitol Public Radio Studios right now, they could see in our lobby some of the jazz art paintings. They're on display for a couple of months, and there'll be a second Saturday reception this coming Saturday evening. Beverly, some of the artists will be there, I guess?
I think so. I can't tell you their names right now, but they're invited.
They're invited. Okay, well.
And we look forward to their coming.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. Beverly Caron-Wasser, curator of the Jazz Art Project, Kelly Rivera, one of the artists in the Jazz Art Project, and Ivan Lurie, art appreciator, a longtime associate of the Jazz Art Group of Painters. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been lovely. Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our associate producers today, Lynn Weaver and Liz Cazares. The assistant producer of Insight is James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. On the next Insight, should younger teenage girls have access to the HPV vaccine without parental consent? A California bill would do that. We heard from opponents earlier this week, and now we'll talk to supporters. Plus, help for cash-strapped Californians who want to stay in their homes. And you'll meet the new director of the University of the Pacific's Brubeck Institute. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.